This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The weekly news review begins now. We've got WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson, who thankfully just raced across the hall from doing the newscast at noon. We appreciate you being
here. Sure, I was supposed to tell anybody that, but thanks, Michael.
You have been running around this morning. It's been a busy day for you because you started the day at probate court in Hamilton County, where Cincinnati City Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, who's also facing federal charges, which we'll get to in just a moment, but this was related to a group that wants to see her tossed off the council now. Can you tell us a little bit about what went down this morning?
Sure. So the anti-tax group Coast is representing five taxpayers in a lawsuit against Tamaya Denard, and this was filed just yesterday, I believe, and these taxpayers want to see her removed from council. And so showed up in court today, and the city and her attorney said, hey, we just found out about this, less than 24 hours ago, and the judge acknowledged that. And the reason for the taxpayers in wanting to do this, because the judge pointed out this could be a moot point if she decides to resign on her own, is Kurt Hartman representing the taxpayers and Coast just said, well, you know, you should be able to trust your representatives and your lawmakers. And you know, we don't want to rely on whatever she may or may not decide. But the city has a number of options, too. The city solicitor's office has been put in kind of an odd position because normally it would be representing council members. In this case, it needs to decide if it wants to prosecute, ask for a recusal, appoint a special prosecutor, or decline to prosecute.
And for those who may be unfamiliar, we'll just note that Coast is, I guess, broadly characterized as a sort of anti-tax
group.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Now, I read some reporting from you and others that at court today, the presiding judge, sort of characterized the proceeding in the context of the recent presidential impeachment trial.
He did, actually. And so he said that he could be compared to Justice Roberts, and Coast and the taxpayers are the House, and the city are the House lawyers, and the jury would be the Senate.
Can we hear the argument from Denard's counsel? What is their position on whether she should remain? It's kind of a weird position to be in, arguing against this point that Coast is trying to make while also suggesting that maybe next week she steps down on her own.
Right. So the attorney, Eric Larson, he didn't really, as I recall, say a lot in court. He just said, look, I've just, you know, been advised of this, just heard about it 24 hours ago. Now, out in the hall when he was talking to reporters, he wanted to make sure that she and her rights would be respected. And he said, you know, regardless whether it's this case, the federal case, like, you know, she needs to have due process and she, you know, needs to be represented and it has to be fair. He did say that he's getting a lot of favorable calls from her supporters. So he said, look, not everybody's against her.
Okay, so did we get any indication about what happens next in these proceedings?
The city knows that it has to make a timely decision, and it would do that in a filing, so we don't really know when that's going to happen. I guess that would be the first step, and then, as the judge pointed out again, this whole thing may be moot if she decides to resign next week. But there is a hearing in this case that has been set for March the 9th.
WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson, thanks so much for coming in and giving us this update. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And now for more reporting and analysis on the charges facing Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, we're joined in the studio by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Chris, thank you for coming down.
Happy Bachfest, Michael.
Exactly. Something to look forward to this week.
We need something to look forward
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. And nothing better than that. And we also have giggling alongside with you as WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, who is delaying his own lunch today to come in and talk to us. I appreciate that, Jay.
I did not bring 18 Pringles today.
Well, we'll count how many you brought in.
I actually didn't bring any.
Well, we want to hear from our listeners, too, on what's going on with Councilwoman Denard. So please feel free to give us a call at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So
could I just jump in on something that Ann said?
Sure, Jay.
I assume, and Chris can help me here if I'm wrong, I assume this follows the typical Coast model for lawsuits against the city, and that's why the city is in this position. Whenever Coast files a lawsuit against the city, they have to give the city attorney the chance to basically prosecute the case or prosecute, take the lawsuit to court. Most of the time, the city solicitor has declined to do that, and then that opens a pathway for the Coast lawyers to essentially do it themselves.
I don't know about the doing it themselves, but this the first part of this sounds right to me. I think there's going to be concerns here about the federal government and what it's doing. I mean, basically, they kind of have to put her on trial at the state court level when this is a federal case. The U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't speak to us, right? They don't elaborate a whole lot on these questions. But we already know this week that Joe Dieters has been told that he should stay away from another potential way to remove Tamaya Dennard from counsel because of their concerns. And I think that the city is going to try to probably consult with, if it hasn't already, the U.S. Attorney's Office on whether it needs to be similarly hesitant to kind of pursue this course of action as well.
Questions, comments, join us at 513-419-7100. Let's just start with the basics for those who are maybe catching up today on this story that's been going on all week long about Councilwoman Tamaya Dennard. Chris, give us the background on the charges that she's facing and what is alleged against her.
So she was arrested on Tuesday by the FBI outside of a downtown Starbucks, and she was arraigned later that day. She was charged with bribery. There's some technical terms here, but basically it's public corruption. These are public corruption charges and attempts to extort somebody. And it involves the infamous Hilltop land swap deal. Basically, what the federal government alleges is that she offered her vote up in exchange for money from Tom Gabelman, the attorney for Hamilton County on the banks. This is just extraordinary. And
in the Hilltop site, this is where the music venue, there was some talk about how do we get access to this property to construct a music venue.
It was all about moving Hilltop out of the way so the Bengals would approve the music venue. And they found another way to do it where Hilltop is going to move, but not to a place in the city of Cincinnati, or at least that's the plan as of now. She voted, this scheme, I guess, this alleged scheme was actually carried out. She cast her vote. It was on the losing side of things. And Tom Gabelman gave her the money. She was seeking $15,000. That's what she got. During this time, of course, Tom Gabelman went and advised the FBI as to what was going on. And so they do what they do, and they wired him up. They recorded his phone calls. They gathered the evidence. And so that resulted in charges this week.
So she solicited allegedly money for a vote that did not benefit the people that
– it would have theoretically benefited the county's position on this. And the county, we should really note here, the county spokeswoman told me we had no idea this was going on. We knew nothing about it. We weren't told about it. You know, we knew nothing. The vote would have benefited the county's position, which was that this land should be swapped. Hilltop should move into Queensgate, and that would assuage the Bengals to basically allow this music venue to be built. And of course, the music venue is being built. The county has agreed to move Hilltop to some other location at another date. And the Bengals said, okay, fine, go ahead and build the music venue.
Jay, what can you tell us about Tamaya Dennard? Where did she come from? How did she land this spot on council? Just a little basic information about her story.
I first met her when council member P.G. Sittenfeld was elected to council. She was his, I don't know, chief of staff. She worked for council member Sittenfeld, I believe, for most of his first term, maybe a little bit into the second part of his term, I think maybe 3 years. That's how I came to know her. 2017, she was elected to council, and in between, I think she did have another job from the time she worked for PG until she was elected to council.
The one thing not to forget here is that Dennard also worked for PG's U.S. Senate campaign in 2014 as well. So she was a longtime trusted aide of his, and when you're a city council aide, you get known around the community. You're always dealing with them, and particularly with P.G. Sittenfeld's office, they're very constituent-oriented. They talk to a lot of people. There are community councils, et cetera. So that helps you if you someday want to run for city council. We have a lot of council members who are former aides, including Chris Seelbach is another one.
And I think I'll let Chris weigh in on this, too, as we've had conversations. I think we knew something was going to happen with Tamaya Dennard. I think in my mind, I know there were people who were trying to do news stories on this same topic. And I think that's the thing that I'm a little bit surprised at. I thought the news story would hit first, and then there could be federal or some sort of state or federal investigation. I think I was a little bit surprised that the federal investigation came before their news reports on this.
It was just a couple of weeks ago that there was someone, a federal representative at the city building with
state.
Without a state but investigation that's with a separate, the summons.
But that's a separate issue.
Because there's been reporting for the past few months about some issues that perhaps Councilwoman Denard has managed to face some accusations about. And so do we know any more about what that was?
That was related to the investigation by the state auditor's office as to whether the Gang of Five, which Tamaya was a member of the Gang of Five, should be held. I can't remember the name of the charge.
It's basically whether they should be prosecuted for the text messages that they sent to each other.
Was it dereliction of duty?
It's something akin to that, yeah.
And yes, so Councilwoman Denard and four other members of council were part of a group that were exchanging text messages that was determined to have constituted a quorum which violated sunshine laws. So that's just some quick background on that.
So there's a special prosecutor investigation into that, whether that was criminal conduct. The reason there was a process server looking for her at that time was to basically see if she would cooperate with the prosecutor. The other four are. I don't know whether she is or not now, but I think that issue had been taken care of. This is completely separate from that issue.
Jay, you mentioned that Councilman Denard had previously served on the staff at council of Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld. And Chris, you added that she also worked on Sittenfeld's Senate campaign in 2014, and he lost that year in the primary. But there's also been reporting that she had borrowed some money from another member of council, Greg Landsman, who came forward and said, yes, I loaned her $1,000. He went through the channels apparently necessary, provided some documents to the media as he asked the city solicitor's office whether this was okay to do. They determined that it was. He said he had not been paid back. What is the relationship publicly between Councilwoman Denard and other members of council since she's joined? Has it been mostly positive?
I would say when this term first began in 2018 that she was pretty close to Councilman Landsman. She was obviously pretty close to Councilmember Sittenfeld. And over time, I think things have kind of changed a little bit. You know, they kind of stuck together during the political crisis over Harry Black. All five of them did, including Wendell Young and Chris Seelbach.
And that's the former city manager.
Former city manager, correct. But you kind of have sensed a little bit of distance between her and the other members. You know, I think Councilmember Landsman explained why he gave her $1,000, that he has been taught as a child, right, to help people in need. And she was in need financially. And so that's why he gave her the money. And, of course, he made sure to clear it first.
And even I found this in my email. Thank goodness I save sent emails. In August, September, there had been a couple people say to me that if the Hilltop came to a vote, Tamaya wouldn't be able to vote on it because she had a conflict of interest. And I heard that from a couple people. So I found that on September the 12th, I emailed her and I said, "Hi, Tamaya, I've heard you from a couple people that you may have a conflict on the Hilltop Music venue issue and not able to vote on these issues. Is that true? And what is the nature reason for the conflict?" And that was on September the 12th. And if you look at the federal affidavit, her first meeting with Tom Gabelman wearing the wire was on September the 5th. So again, even prior, you know, the middle part of summer, there were people speculating that there could be issues with her vote on the Hilltop Music venue at City Hall.
We should really talk about some of the details of that affidavit filed by the FBI agent.
Because
it is so puzzling to read that because throughout the quotes that they have from her, she talks several times about wanting to act ethically and making sure that everything was above board. And she even at one point suggests that she would sign a promissory note to Gabelman to pay this money back. The federal government noted, of course, that she brought it up initially and then it kind of went by the wayside. Nothing else happened by that. But then they have quotes from her saying, "Okay, I'll vote the way you want if you give me this money," basically. And so it's completely confusing her line of thinking on this, at least in the affidavit.
And some people, and I would assume that we were talking about this yesterday in the newsroom. What's in that affidavit that we've seen is not the full.
No,
that's not the full recordings of the conversations. That's enough to show probable cause for the charges, but that's not the complete affidavit.
That's correct.
Will she
Are we? Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm playing something on the computer, wondering why I am hearing that noise. I had pulled up her statement. I apologize to everyone. Let me go ahead and.
It's very entertaining.
Mute that. We're all looking around like, where is this noise coming from? And it's me. I apologize to everyone who could pick that up. And also apologize to the local TV station who I guess I just violated the copyright of. So we'll just keep that quiet. I don't mean to make light of the
very
serious situation.
20 seconds or less.
Yeah, I don't think you could even make out what it was. How embarrassing. My apologies to everyone. But since I have this up, let's get to that, because we do need to reiterate that Councilwoman Denard is, her attorneys had issued a statement that says she looks forward to addressing the serious allegations made against her. She understands there are immediate questions about her continued service on city council. She recognizes that her constituents deserve to know whether she will continue to serve in the seat to which she was elected while she works to clear her name. And they went on to say, to that end, Ms. Denard will make a decision about her future on city council by the end of next week. And Councilwoman Denard also posted on her personal Facebook page the following statement, quote, during this incredibly dark and difficult time, I want to thank you for all of the love you've sent my way. The messages, prayers, hugs, the thinking about yous have helped more than you can imagine. Going through hard times have a way of revealing things both about yourself and others. She went on to say thank you to everyone who has made a conscious decision to allow me due process before casting judgment. Judgment is so easy, she said, and then went on to say thank you to everyone who believes in and affirms my goodness. More than anything, I just wanted you to know that I'm all right. She used the hashtag bend, but don't break. We haven't heard much else from her, though.
No. I mean, she has not come out and explained, you know, given her side of the story, you know, filled in any blanks she might think there are in the FBI's affidavit. So we're kind of at a loss as to right now to really explain much more of it.
Do we know, maybe Chris has asked someone, had there been this promissory note, would that have made a difference?
I don't think so. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, if the promissory note, if she borrowed the money and signed a promissory note and then didn't vote, maybe.
Because I'm just running through my mind, like if I were a council member and I have my mortgage with Fifth Third Bank.
Right.
Or is there, I mean, there's a promissory note that I have with Fifth Third Bank. I mean, how could it, I'm just wondering if there's any difference if it was a loan as opposed to a gift.
Look, the bottom line, I think, is you cannot exchange anything for your vote, whether it's campaign contribution or money or whatever. That's the core question here, is whether that is what she did. And, you know, the process is going to play out. I mean, we're not lawyers. We only play them here on the radio, I guess, you know. I mean, so that's kind of where we are on it.
It will be interesting to see. There was also an article that came out in the Inquirer yesterday where two other developers said they were approached and said no, to see if the FBI will question them as part of this process.
One of those instances was where she allegedly asked for help, you know, paying the rent, basically giving a few more months. I'm not sure that's quite the same thing as what she's been charged with. And in the other case, there doesn't appear to be any kind of quid pro quo suggested. So what the FBI has alleged is it's about as serious a corruption charge as you can possibly imagine a public official facing.
And the attorney who served as the informant in these allegations, Tom Gableman, who was serving the county in a legal capacity, he is in private practice, right? He is someone
Correct.
Who is with Frost Brown.
He's not an employee of the county, but they have long
right.
contracted with him to deal with the banks. Tom Gableman, there is no one that knows more about the riverfront development than him. And that's why this was so utterly shocking. Number one, that he would play this role in this. It makes sense to me because Tom has said repeatedly, particularly during this Hilltop debate, he always emphasized that he thought he was doing what was best for the city and the region. And so it makes complete sense why he did what he did. Frost Brown Todd issued a statement praising him for his involvement. Nevertheless, I am sure that he does not want to be in the spotlight, you know, that he has found himself in.
So if Councilwoman Denard decides next week that she's going to step down, that creates a vacancy, and we're dealing with the vacancy currently as well. So what happens at City Hall?
Each council member, when the council term begins, there's a successor designee certificate they fill out. And I believe that on Council Member Denard's, P.G. Sittenfeld is the council member who would name her replacement. Now, that was filed on December
2018.
In January of 2018. She can change that at any time. So today she could file a new certificate and completely change that. And she could even do that minutes before she resigns and, you know, make that. But as it stands right now, Councilmember Sittenfeld would name her replacement.
Okay, so we have to deal with the replacement of a candidate, Amy Murray, who was term limited anyway and would be leaving, and she's joining the Trump administration. We don't know for sure what Councilwoman Denard's decision will be next week, but if she does leave, that will create a vacancy that will ultimately lead to an appointment of a successor as well. You have multiple other members of council who are term limited out, a mayor's race next time around. I'm not asking you to be a government meteorologist here, but my goodness, we had already talked previously in the context of the term limits that some of these folks are facing.
What they call the winter storms on the coast a bomb cyclone. Yeah. This could be the bomb cyclones of council elections, because if Tamaya were to step down, you would have seven council members who have not been on the ballot. Well, let's say seven incumbent council members running. There'd be five vacancies, council members who can't run for reelection, and two new appointees who have not been on the ballot before.
I mean, has there been any time recently where there had been such significant change to the makeup of Cincinnati city government? You're going to have a new mayor. You're going to have many new council members, more than two-thirds.
Not to this degree. I mean, in 2000 and in the election of 2011, a lot of incumbents were driven off the council because of the SB 5 bill brought out such a huge Democratic turnout that year.
Remind us what that was.
SB 5 was the anti-union bill that Governor Kasich passed and was put to a referendum statewide. And that, of course, every labor union in the state was persuading, you know, Democrats to come out to vote and kill that thing. I also think we should consider the possibility that she may not resign anytime soon. When you look at other public corruption cases across the country, usually when you enter a plea deal, one of the chips that you have is that you still hold your office, and as a result of the plea deal, you will resign. That's leverage that she, you know, I hate to use that term, but it's one of the few things she still has. It may take the amount of time it takes to make a deal with the feds, if that's the route they choose to go, if they don't go to trial, in order for her to leave council.
It could also make business a little more complicated if she doesn't resign but doesn't attend the meetings. A lot of what council does, they have a rule suspension. That takes seven council votes to suspend where an ordinance has to be read at three different meetings. And if she's not there and a couple of other council members are gone for sickness or vacation, if they get down to like six council members, it's going to take a lot longer to get some business through the
council. You know, Jay, they may just have to follow the charter and read the ordinances on three separate days. I mean, it'll be tough.
I know everybody criticizes that rule, but I don't know that there's a city council or right. village government anywhere in the state that doesn't do it.
Right. So then people are going to have to plan.
We have seen some support on Councilman Denard's social media as well. Who is her constituency? Who are the people that are standing beside her now amidst these charges?
You know, and I'm not saying that these folks support her today, but it's important to remember in respect to this that she had broad support in 2017. She was both kind of considered, you know, the candidate there's kind of a left-wing group associated with Bernie Sanders, and I can't remember the name right now. But she was endorsed by them, but also she was rated highly by the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. And so she had, you know, kind of broad support as somebody who was a reasonable person who they felt that they could deal with, that both sides could deal with. Today, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of African-American supporters of hers who look at this and you know, they want due process. They want her to go through the process before making any judgment about whether she should stay or leave. And there's been a lot of, over the years, we've seen a lot of African-American leaders in this town, you know, find themselves crossways in the media or with the law or whatever. And, you know, I think people are worn out by that. And She may be guilty. Everything the FBI says may be true, but at the same time, there are people who are saying, look, we want due process.
All right. I want to thank Chris Wederick from the Cincinnati Business Courier, and we might have to have you back next week, depending on what shapes up, to join Jay here, Jay Hansman from WVXU. Jay, thank you for coming in as well. Go have your lunch. I'm going to use this upcoming break to fire off an email about the dangers of auto video on websites. Apologize again for that. Thanks to all of you for being in with us. And just ahead, a look at seven abortion-related bills in Frankfurt, as well as a piece of legislation inspired by the Covington Catholic students' news-making trip to Washington last year. and how Governor Beshear's appearance alongside drag queens is being used against him. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with Courier-Journal reporter Deborah Yetter as we turn our focus to abortion-related legislation in Frankfort. Deborah's on the phone with us. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, we do appreciate it. And you had an article this week that outlined the numerous bills that are pending before the General Assembly.
Yeah, that's true. It was getting a little hard to keep track of them all, so we decided just to consolidate them all in a single story. So since Republicans took control of both chambers of the Kentucky legislature in 2017, there have been a series of bills each year. This year, I think, could be the most that have been filed. There's seven, and they start with one called the Conscience Bill, which passed a Senate committee last week, and that would allow health professionals from a broad range of areas to exempt themselves from any procedure or medication they have a conscientious objection to. And then there are a series of others if you want me to delineate
them. Well, we will go through some of them. Since you noted that there's been a series of them since the Republicans had control in 2017, why is this happening? Why are there so many different ones? Why isn't that caucus sort of on the same page on what the party's position is on abortion?
Well, I think in part there are people who feel very strongly about this and want to have their own bills, and they're always looking for some area they believe that may not have been addressed in previous bills. Opponents would argue that it's a political thing. They've basically dealt with most aspects of abortion in Kentucky now, short of abolishing it until Roe v. Wade, should Roe v. Wade be overturned. But it offers them the opportunity to say they're continuing to fight abortion to the folks back home.
One of our state representatives from Northern Kentucky, Joe Fisher, a Republican from Fort Thomas, he's behind what is called the Constitutional Amendment Bill. And can you tell us a little bit about what that would do?
Now, Joe Fisher last year sponsored a bill that became law that's called a trigger bill. In the event Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion would become illegal in Kentucky. That law is on the books. This year, he has come back with a second bill that is to clarify things. He didn't really elaborate on it at a very short hearing last week, but it would make sure it would spell out in the Constitution there's no state constitutional right to abortion, and that if it's been enacted by the General Assembly would go on the ballot in November, and I think what might draw more attention from voters.
And we are talking to Deborah Yetter, a reporter from the Courier-Journal, about a series of abortion-related bills pending before the Kentucky General Assembly. And Deborah, one of them you refer to as the gag rule.
Yes, that has, and a lot of these have been brought up in other states as well, and this would keep anyone who gets public money from counseling anyone about the possibility of an abortion under the threat of losing the public money. Critics say that it's too broad, that it could apply at a counseling center where a pregnant person seeking mental health treatment is also inquiring about abortion, but if they get public money, they wouldn't be able to advise her about that possibility, and that's why they're calling it a gag rule.
Representative Nancy Tate, a Republican from Meade County, she, according to your reporting, is calling for, quote, the dignified treatment of fetal remains. What does she mean by that?
Well, that also has been passed in other states, including Indiana, and that would require that fetal remains from a miscarriage or abortion be either cremated or interred by a licensed funeral director, which would certainly add to the regulatory process and to the expense.
Lexington Republican Stan Lee has a couple of these bills that you profiled. One is related to auditing abortion records. The other is related to the way the attorney general would enforce. Could you help us understand those two?
Yes, the auditing would allow them, the state authorities to audit, or the state auditor specifically, to audit clinics that provide abortions to make sure they are following a state law to report those to the State Department of Vital Statistics, which they do now. This has been controversial in some states because of privacy concerns and the fact that this would open up medical records and so forth and individual records to a public inspection by the state auditor. This bill hasn't been heard yet, so it's not clear how broad it is or what it might do and whether there's much opposition to it. And the Attorney General would expand the authority of the Attorney General to enforce abortion violations of abortion law and also allow him to seek civil or criminal penalties as well as just taking some kind of administrative steps against anyone in violation of abortion laws or regulations. I think that's in part out of frustration with the current Governor Andy Beshear and his cabinet have indicated they are going to follow Roe v. Wade and support abortion rights. And they are looking to opponents of abortion are looking to someone to be more aggressive in enforcement. And Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who's a Republican and is opposed to abortion, I think they might prefer him to do that.
State Senator Whitney Westerfield, who's from Hopkinsville, wanted to be the Attorney General a couple election cycles ago. He remains in the state Senate, and he's got a piece of legislation, the Infant Born Alive Bill. It's already passed the Senate and is waiting consideration in the House. What does this mean?
And that's another, there's also a similar measure that is yet to get through Congress that, or through the Senate that McConnell has been, U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell has been supporting. And basically it would require that should an infant be survive a late-term abortion, they would have to, the medical professionals would have to do everything they could to save the infant, which I think medical ethics already provides for. Kentucky doesn't allow late-term abortions. In fact, law bans abortions after 20 weeks into a pregnancy. Senator Westerfield simply said he wants the law in the books as a precaution and just in the event that something like this should ever happen.
You started to touch on this a little bit, that Governor Andy Beshear plans to follow the federal law that was prompted by the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. Ultimately, if he were to veto any of these bills, were they to come out of the full General Assembly, the Republicans do have a veto proof majority, do they not?
They absolutely do. They have super majorities in both chambers and could easily override any such vetoes and probably would, and my impression would be.
And then the courts would await more than likely.
Yeah. And they're still dealing with two of four laws passed last year are tied up in federal court now. In the 2019 session, one was the fetal heartbeat bill that's still been stayed by federal litigation, a challenge, and another banning abortion because of the race and the gender or disability of the fetus has also been blocked by a federal court challenge.
Well, we do appreciate you outlining those seven bills. You can read more about those in the Courier-Journal. And we've got a couple minutes left. Deborah, I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit about the legislation as it relates to our neighbors in Park Hills, the Covington Catholic students who had gone to Washington, D.C. We are all very well familiar with the incident that followed there on the National Mall in January of 2019. There's a piece of legislation sponsored by Kenton County Senator, a Republican, Chris McDaniel. It's anti-doxing is kind of how it's referred to. What can you tell us about it?
Right. And that just came up yesterday in the legislature and passed in the Senate committee. And everyone, of course, remembers the incident involving the Catholic Covington Catholic teen last year in Washington at the Washington Monument. This bill, doxing is when you spread information online, personal information about a person with the intent of having other people harass them. And that is what Nick Sandman's father, Ted Sandman, Nick Sandman was a student at issue here. Ted Sandman has testified that the family just underwent enormous harassment and attacks online and threats and so forth after that video of his son went viral. So last year they proposed this bill in the session. A little bit late, it didn't get through, so they're back with it again, and it would make it a misdemeanor to put a youth, someone under 18, their personal information online with the intent of causing, someone to harass them. It would make it a felony if someone acting on that information actually caused physical or monetary harm, say a job loss, because of that.
And so the similar bill from last year did get through the Senate, failed to win approval in the House, and now this newer version, this updated version, is now going to be considered by the full Senate. Do we have any timeline on this particular piece of legislation, Deborah?
I have not heard. It just came up for its first hearing yesterday, and I mean, there's still time to get it through if they work at it, but we are getting, you know, more than halfway through the session now, and there's a lot of stuff backing up.
Deborah Yetter is a reporter with the Louisville Courier-Journal. Deborah, thank you so much for taking some time to explain this legislation to us today.
You're welcome.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with Lexington Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers, who joins us on the phone. Daniel, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. We do expect to be joined at some point by Louisville Courier-Journal reporter Joe Sanko. We've not yet connected with him, but if we are able to connect with him, we'll bring him into the conversation. But Daniel, I wanted to start with you anyway, because you've had some interesting reporting this week as it relates to drag queens and legislators and the governor, Andy Beshear. And I'm hoping that you could help our audience, who may be unfamiliar with this story so far, understand what's happening.
Yes, it's a tried and true example of politics talking about gay issues and drag queens. So earlier this month, Andy Beshear, the governor, he became the first governor to speak at one of these statewide fairness rallies, which they hold every year because, you know, it's still legal to discriminate against LGBT people in both housing and employment in Kentucky. You can still fire someone for being gay and deny them an apartment. So Beshear spoke at this rally in favor of this fairness bill. And right afterwards, as he's heading to the governor's office, there's a group of people. They're called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And this is an LGBT charity group. It dates back to San Francisco in the 1970s. And they dress up kind of like nuns, right? So it's a lot of black and white imagery. One of them, Sister Sandy V, had a KFC bucket that she turned into a nun's habit and a fabulous fur jacket. And so they're posing with Beshear, and they snap a picture. And both me and Joe Sanka take a picture of Beshear posing with this group, and we tweet it out. So this week I found out that in a special election for the state house in District 99, which used to be controlled by Rocky Adkins, the Republicans were circulating this photo. So it was posted on Facebook, and it got one of the posts got 384 shares, which is a lot of shares on Facebook. That means a lot of people saw it. But it also there was a sitting state senator, Senator Philip Wheeler. He's from Pikeville, and he was talking to a crowd in Elliott County. The weekend leading up to the election. The election was Tuesday. And so he was talking in support of the Republican candidate, a guy named Richard White. And right after the Pledge of Allegiance, he takes out his phone and he shows the crowd a picture, this picture that Joe and I took of Beshear with the drag queens. And he walks it around the room. So he literally walks it to each table showing these people the picture. And he's kind of using this rhetoric that, you know, has long been used against the LGBT community, right? So I'm gay. I grew up going to church every weekend, and it's really familiar rhetoric to me. It's this idea that, you know, you can't have gay people around children, that they're harmful to children. And he said, this is what the Democratic Party stands for today. This is what our Democratic governor stands for today. This is what he wants our children to be around, as he's showing this picture of these drag queens in religious imagery.
And we should...
Well, go ahead.
I just want to note that the Republican did win in that state house race.
Yes, yeah. And so this was like the first time that seat has been Republican in like 33 years.
And Elliott County has historical ties to the Democratic Party that also ended back in 2016, right? It was like the county that voted for the Democratic presidential candidate the most consecutive times until 2016, when it went for Trump. And Rocky Adkins, who is now part of Governor Beshear's administration, had held onto this seat as a Democrat, and now it's in Republican hands.
Exactly, yes. And so the Republicans were celebrating this race. They're saying, look, we flipped this seat. Part of the reason that I think that it hadn't been flipped earlier is that, you know, Rocky Adkins was the one who held the seat, and he was just kind of this longstanding Democrat who had a lot of goodwill in the county. I mean, he dominated Eastern Kentucky in the Democratic governor primary. Like, he, you know, he's really in touch with the community. And now that it's an open seat, these are the type of seats that we've seen flip as Kentucky's kind of made this transition to becoming more and more of a Republican state. So certainly, yes, that's the case there.
Have we heard Senator Wheeler respond to the calls for his resignation?
Yes, we have. So that's the other aspect, right? So I called Senator Wheeler to talk about this both when I broke the story and in the follow-up as people called for his resignation. And his line of defense is that it was about the way the people were dressed, right? That he doesn't have any problem with the gay community. It's about the way the people were dressed. He didn't like that they, you know, one of the people had horns, that there was the nun's habit. And so he, that was his argument, right? And like I said, like we've seen this argument before, it's what we call a dog whistle, right? It's a type of message that is geared toward a certain community. And, you know, the people who are in the know understand what he's saying. And it is this kind of fear mongering about LGBT people. And so Governor Beshear, in a press conference yesterday, basically called that out, right? When I pointed out that this was what Philip Wheeler's argument was that it was about the way they were dressed, Beshear instantly said, no, like that, he said that after you called him out, and he said, this was absolutely homophobic. The last time I checked, Senator Wheeler is not the fashion police in the Capitol. And so it's been kind of interesting to see, you know, Beshear is really sticking with his guns on this one. He's really saying, you know, I would take that picture again. You know, that was the right thing to do. And this is, we need to be a Capitol that's inclusive and fair to everyone. And House Speaker David Osborne actually echoed a similar message today where he was like, you know, we need to make sure that the Capitol is an inclusive place to everyone, which was interesting. You know, it's interesting to see the reaction to this as it's come out.
Yeah. And I guess the governor's not buying the argument that the commentary was just about whether horns and heels go together.
Yeah. I mean, because Senator Wheeler has this, I mean, like, did not specifically say anything about the LGBT community when he was talking about it, right? He was using this kind of vague language that gives him plausible deniability, but he was literally walking around with his phone showing a picture of Beshear with a group of drag queens during the fairness rally. So there's only so much deniability that he really can have in this situation.
And let's bring in Joe Sonka. He's on the line with us now, a reporter from the Courier-Journal. Joe, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Absolutely. And there is some legislation that is moving in spite of some of the spectacles and offensive things that come out of each, I guess, General Assembly session. And one such thing is related to an issue we've had you on to talk about at length back when Governor Matt Bevin was on his way out of office and made all those controversial pardons. Now it looks like Northern Kentucky Senator Chris McDaniel's legislation that would limit the governor's pardon power is moving forward.
Yes, he has a bill that would limit, amend the state constitution to limit a governor's ability to issue pardons and commutations at the end of their term. So 30 days before a general election, and then the time between that election and the time that the next governor is sworn into office, they could not make any pardons. And McDaniel's reasoning is that if a governor wants to pardon someone, that's fine, but they have to do it in the light of day, where the voters can judge them based on those pardons, whether they like them or not, and not, you know, as they're going out the door and, you know, doing favors for powerful people. So that was his reasoning. It passed the Senate easily. There are a lot of different constitutional amendments up in Frankfurt this year, and there are only a small amount that can actually get onto the ballot. So it's yet to be seen whether voters are actually going to be able to vote on that. If it passes both chambers, it gets put on the ballot for voters to approve or disapprove in the election this fall.
I mean, this isn't the only piece of legislation, though, that is, I guess, meant to either penalize or at least restrict the powers of the current governor and the next governors based right on what our immediately previous governor did.
Right. And there's another bill which would... basically, right now, a governor can appoint his own secretary of the transportation cabinet. There's a bill that would instead create a commission where the Chamber of Commerce and other local government groups would give nominees to this name nominees to a board, and the governor would have to choose among those nominees for a cabinet secretary. And the reasoning of Republicans say is that, well, this will bring all of the politics out of awarding road funds, which has been abused in the past. And Republican President Stivers pointed to Matt Bevin abusing that last year when he accused them of basically hoarding all of this road money and then delivering almost all of it right before the election to try to win favor of local officials. But of course, Beshear and Democrats are crying foul, saying that they're trying to punish the current Democratic governor for the sins of the past governor or past governors, and saying that's really all about wielding power and taking it away from Beshear instead of high-minded reforms.
Okay, a significant piece of legislation that passed the lower chamber of the General Assembly is related to medical marijuana. I've seen some people who are big fans of legalized marijuana legislation who don't necessarily like this bill. It passed by a 65-30 vote. What is this bill, and is it dead upon arrival in the Senate, Joe?
We don't know yet. Part of what we were waiting for this week was to see which committee it would be placed in the Senate. There are certain committees where it would have a good chance of getting out of there and getting onto the floor for a vote. And there's another committee where everyone expects it will die. So we're kind of waiting to see which committee the Senate president places the bill in. He said he would do so this week, but he did not. So we're still kind of waiting on that. So the bill is basically it would be the most restrictive medical marijuana law in the country.
It's basically just edibles, right? I mean, there's not going to be any flower that people are smoking. It's just edibles.
You're not allowed to smoke, but you can still buy the flower.
Oh, I gotcha.
You can obtain the flower. It's just illegal to smoke it. So you have to, if you want to process in that own way, whatever you want to ingest it, that's fine. You just can't smoke it. So so it would be the most restrictive in the country. The proponents of that say that, and the opponents of it both say that. It's just a question of whether Stivers and the Republican caucus is going to go along with it in the Senate to allow it to get to a floor vote. And Stivers himself has been very skeptical of the value of medical marijuana, says that more research needs to be done to make sure that it doesn't have harmful effects, which is because the same argument that was given by a lot of Republican members of the House that voted against it. It has almost universal support among Democrats, but there's a more social conservative kind of faction among Republicans that are still quite skeptical of it.
And the out that we've seen for a lot of the social conservatives who are reluctant to pass this is that they talk about research, right? So because marijuana is still scheduled at the highest level in the federal government, that means that it's kind of limited the amount of research that can be done on the drug itself. So they've been kind of pushing for the federal government to make a change about this rather than dealing with it at the state level. And it's a little bit of one of those where you can pass the buck, right? If you can say, oh, well, the federal government should change this policy so that we can study it more, it allows them to buy a little bit of time before they have to pass this thing, which they're getting surveys back from their district that, it's like 90% of people in their district support the legislation. Several lawmakers have talked about how much support this type of legislation has in their district.
Daniel, I've got a question in my inbox here. Does that mean you can vape the marijuana, or does that count as smoking?
I believe you can. I think you can't. Yeah. What?
Oh, split decision here.
I think it prohibits combustible smoking, but I'm not entirely sure that it prohibits vaping.
My goodness. Well, we'll continue to follow the progress on that. I do want to thank both Lexington Herald leader reporter Daniel DeRochers and Louisville Courier Journal reporter Joe Sonka. Always great to have you both on. Thanks for joining us today.
Yep, thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.